The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Sebastian, hey, man, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm really excited about the conversation we have for our listeners today. We're joined by Dorit Aronov, who's a professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and really one of the pioneers in the field. She's also the chief science officer at KEDMA, which is a really interesting quantum startup based in Israel as well. And I was just really excited to get a chance to talk to Dorit.
Yeah, I think, Sebastian, we're really lucky actually to get Dorit on the podcast. She's actually one of the major movers and shakers around quantum error correction and co-author on the major, highly important threshold theorem for quantum error correction. She'll get into that in some depth. But, you know, just given how big a year it's been in quantum error correction, it was truly a privilege, I think, to have her perspective on this important subject. And sort of see a glimpse, right, of what the future could bring in terms of these technologies and algorithms.
We got a great view of her sort of origin story, which was a treat as well. And then we also talked a bunch about some recent work she's done on sort of the theoretical foundations of a technique called random circuit sampling. And we sort of left out the context a little bit, I'm afraid, in our conversation. So the reason that's a topic of interest is that it's the approach that Google used in their so-called supremacy experiment in October 2019. So it was a technique to try to prove that their chip could perform a task I think it was a matter of a couple hundred seconds instead of a couple hundred thousand years or something on that scale by classical means. And that was really interesting to delve into her recent work on that as well.
And it was an interesting news event, you know, at the time. I mean, many of these, you know, big breakthroughs in quantum computing research, that they're hard to really grapple with in real time. Yeah. But big splash when it happened, a little bit of controversy, but some major names worked on that release. So her perspective on that and this paper, I think, really put that very claim into perspective. So I think it's a great intro to this great interview with Dorit.
Okay, so we are joined today with a very special guest. We have Dorit Aronov with us. She's a professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and a quantum information scientist. And we're really excited to get a chance to talk with Dorit. She played an important role in the fault tolerance theorem and more recently has done some work on random circuit sampling in the research and is also the chief science officer at KEDMA, which is really interesting. Quantum startup in Israel. So, Dorit, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you, Kevin. Nice to be here.
Pleasure to have you on today. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, Dorit, we'd love to always start with guests with sort of getting a little bit of a bio because we find that everyone has their own path into quantum information, into quantum computing. And it's always really fascinating to here's sort of the twists and turns that each person's individual story has taken. So where did you start on your path towards quantum information and how did you get here?
So basically I did my master's degree at the Weizmann Institute after studying, after doing my BSc at the Hebrew University. And already before I started my BSc, actually, I wanted to do brain research. This was my main goal. And And I was looking for a master's advisor in brain research, and I couldn't find one at Weizmann Institute. And then I gave an advice to a friend to at some conversation at a party to go check out the Hebrew University. Then I told myself, well, why wouldn't I check that? And I sort of, I don't know exactly why, but I had a feeling that in the computer science department, I would find something interesting. And I kind of knocked on the door of my to-be advisor, Michael Benor, and I wanted to talk to him about brain research. But then he told me, look, there's something really interesting going on, something that might interest you. And he gave me a paper about quantum computation. And it just seemed to be so – that was in 95, 1 year after Shor's algorithm.
Wow.
And
wow,
he was talking about error correction and about the question of whether – I didn't understand a word of what he was saying. But I took this paper, and it just caught me as something extremely interesting.
Do you remember which paper it was?
It was Deutsch's paper, I think.
Ah, okay, yeah,
Deutsch's
yeah.
Definition of quantum circuits.
Right. That's a foundational work for sure.
Yes.
And an exciting time in the field.
Yeah, it's an extremely important paper. And I remember reading it and reading it again and again and again for months until I finally got it. Like nobody understood quantum computation at the time. So
yeah, sure. Yeah.
So the one thing that I really didn't understand was the connection between the exponentially many dimensions and the n qubits, you know, just the very basics of the model. And it, I remember the moment when I actually got it in the library.
That's awesome.
Fantastic story. And it's also interesting how quantum computation, even though it's so formidable in its abstraction, it does draw people in, even though they perhaps at first don't really understand, right? There's some magnetic draw.
It's pretty compelling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's compelling. I think. I mean, I think you can sense the depth. I think quantum computation is really special in its depth and its connections to so many things in mathematics that you really can sense it without even understanding anything by just knowing that, you know, the definitions are they seem to be mind-boggling even before you really grasp.
Right. Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, I like to joke that if anyone knows anything about quantum physics, it's probably that it's really, really hard to understand.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, this is such a pleasure to have you on, Dorit. I think it might be good if it's okay for you to start to jump into the talk of the fault tolerance theorem and the threshold theorem. You're a fundamental contributor on that front. I mean, our audience are people who are, you know, math and science amateurs. Some professionals, some people are into, you know, deep tech and trying to grapple with, quantum computation and what it might mean for the future. And so, I mean, we're trying to, if we can, come up with, you know, in-depth explanations of these challenging topics, but still stay away from all of the abstraction. I'm wondering, I mean, that's a challenging ask I'm making of you, but is it possible for you to give a go at trying to explain the threshold theorem in that context?
Sure. Yeah, actually, it's not. I don't think it's that complicated to explain.
Good.
from the point of view of so I think that it starts from the amazing discovery by Peter Shor and Steen of quantum error correcting codes.
Yes.
And this was really at the time in 95. Nobody actually believed that it is possible to correct. Errors that occur on quantum states because of the lack of reversibility. It's like, you know, a state is being measured. How can you recover from such an irreversible event? Mm. But once you have a quantum error correcting code, then basically the true question is, can you actually compute on encoded states while performing the error correction with noisy gates?
Yes.
So the whole idea, so let me start even earlier. Why would you even be interested in this question of whether you can compute in the presence of noise? That's the main subject of the fault tolerance theorem. So
yes.
So if quantum computers were completely ideal, then we know that there are these algorithms like Shor's algorithm and other algorithms that seem to be We don't really have a proof of that, but they seem to be exponentially better and faster than classical algorithms.
Yes.
And so the
yes.
real question that was you know, very, very pressing at the time, around just after Shor's algorithm, was is it really due? Is this amazing computational complexity that quantum computers promise? Is it due to the to extreme accuracy, to the high accuracy that we require from the gates and from the states, or is it okay to perform the computation in the presence of noise in a non-ideal situation, and still that the quantum system will maintain its exponential advantage? And this is critical because there are models of computation where if you require infinite accuracy, you can actually derive exponential advantages or even more. But if you get to, you know, to real requirements, real physical systems with realistic requirements from the model, with finite precision, finite energy that you use for every elementary step, etc., then suddenly the advantage is lost. So of course, it's a very natural question to ask, does this happen to a quantum computer? Or is it, it could be that it's just an ideal, you know, that the advantage is just within an ideal framework, but once you make it realistic, then the whole promise disappears.
And this is interesting, Dorothy, forgive me for interrupting, but if I'm not mistaken, the rise of analog computation and the theory around that, if it was assuming infinite precision, it could make breakthrough new capacities, but that's obviously not physically realizable. Do I have that correct? That was one of the tangents to the theory around analog computing.
So I'm not sure which theory you actually mean when you talk about theory of analog computing. Are you referring to something related to quantum computation or more generally?
Oh, it was before quantum computation, but I thought there was at least some tangent within the theory of computation related to analog computers. And there was, you know, an early era of computation where there was a debate about, you know, digital versus analog, and people were exploring the limits of and comparing both systems. And so I have some abstract memory of that tangent to the theory of computation.
There is a very deep theory of analog quantum of analog computation, not quantum computation. But I was referring especially to an example of just a theoretical example of how to actually factorize numbers if you have infinite algebraic precision.
So
that wasn't with the suggestion of a particular physical system. It was just an example of how if you assume non-physical assumptions like infinite precision, you can get extremely complex and powerful computers. So the name of the game is actually to achieve advantage while not making extravagant assumptions like infinite precision, but just making realistic assumptions. And that was the starting point for the question, first of all, about quantum error correcting codes and the amazing discoveries of those. And then in 1995, when I started my MSc, basically, which turned into a PhD, we were wondering whether actually quantum error correcting codes can be used in order to compute on a noisy quantum computer and maintain the quantum advantage, the computational advantage. And the whole idea is, well, first of all, the difficulty is that the error correcting itself, it's a procedure that you have to, you know, you basically have some kind of a state that is somehow, if there are errors occurring on that state, then you could, in principle, detect those errors and reverse them. But in order to detect those errors, you have to perform various operations. And in order to correct them, you have to perform more operations. And all these new operations are also faulty. They're also noisy.
Right.
So if you take a state that is noisy and then you start playing with it with noisy operations, you might only do more harm than good. And the question is, can you actually use noisy operations to on noisy states such that the noise doesn't do more harm than good, but it actually sort of maintains the amount of error below a certain level all the time. And that was, and this is an engineering task, and that is what we did, me and Michael Benor, my advisor, my PhD advisor, we actually found a way so basically the key point is that there's sort of a tension between two forces. One is the force of the error, that yes. the errors comets at a certain rate, and they sort of ruin the coherence and the entanglement in the system at a certain rate. And then the noise correction are gates that create entanglement and that sort of get rid of these of this noise that the faults introduce. And these are two forces that combat each other. And the point is that if both of them act at the same rate, they're sort of on an equal footing. And if one of them has a slightly faster rate, then it wins. And there is a critical point where actually if the noise correction works essentially faster than the errors accumulate, then you can actually get control of the noise, of the errors, and maintain the errors below a certain level that does not grow through the computation. And this happens at a critical point, and that's the threshold.
Interesting.
Beautiful. Interesting.
And is the let's say, the velocity that the error correction happens versus the generation of errors in the computation, is that dependent on a more engineering sort of physical implementation of the error correction, or is it dependent yes. on the algorithm, or both?
Yeah. This is a beautiful question, which I'm still, so that was, I don't know how okay. long ago, but I'm still fascinated by this question because I feel, so the original proof of ours and also of Nila Flam and Zurich and Kitaev, they also had other proofs of the same, more or less the same theorem. These original proofs are very, very engineering-like. So basically the value of the threshold, the error rate that right. below which we can actually correct. And once we can correct the noisy quantum computation, only needs to be slightly larger than ideal quantum computation, and it will still work. So these constructions, these protocols, are extremely engineering-like. Basically, the threshold comes from designing a certain error correction procedure and a certain computation procedure on encoded quantum states such that the errors doesn't propagate too much in the exact circuits and so on and so forth. It's very engineering-like. And I personally don't like this. I think that it doesn't explain well fault tolerance because really it's a physics phenomenon. There is a sort of below a certain threshold, we can think of this as if the system is capable of some completely different behavior, like ice and water. It's just like a phase transition. Below that, there would be macroscopic entanglement and control of ability to control large-scale quantum correlations. And above it, they would not be. This would not be possible. And this distinction between two sort of really very different behaviors in nature, at this point, it's explained by computer science tools, and that is wrong, I think. I mean, really, it's a physics phenomenon.
Interesting.
And a physics phenomena should be explained in a physics language.
Right.
And I think we're still missing such a theory.
This is so fascinating. Sorry, are you even more powerfully asserting there's a deeper connection between, say, you know, the phases of matter and the transition between, you know, solid and liquid and these quantum error correction thresholds? Is there a more powerful analogy there?
I think that there is some kind of an analogy between different phases of matter and the situation in fault tolerant systems in which below a certain threshold there is a different type of behavior of matter in which long range quantum correlations, controllable ones, are possible, whereas above it, they're not.
Interesting. And I think you did a postdoc, I believe, at the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton. Is that right?
That's true, yeah.
Did you find any, I'm just curious if there was any sort of echoes or resonance in the work that von Neumann had done with the original IAS system, where a lot of the foundations of classical error correction sort of get laid down in the mid-40s when they were building that system, right?
Definitely, definitely. First of all, yeah. it was wonderful to be in that place for a year.
I bet. Wow.
And yes, of course. I mean, this whole question of can you perform computation in the presence of noise, von Neumann studied it in the context of classical computations. And me and my advisor, when we thought about this, that this was the starting point for us, where True. Basically there is von Neumann used majority gates to perform the corrections. And quantumly, this is much more complicated. But but the essence
they had it easy.
Yeah, they had it
easy. The classical.
I think that's actually not true because they had it, without a star. But the idea, the basic idea, the ingenious idea of von Neumann to compute an uncoded states, this is also something that we took from. This also goes into the quantum world.
Wow. So that's interesting. So cool. Yeah, because phase transitions in matter. I mean, there's some deep water out there on statistical thermodynamics and what actually even means to express precisely and physically a phase transition. So that sounds like a fascinating domain of possible future research.
Yeah, I would love to see such I'm actually working on that also today, but also I think that there is some deep theory that's waiting to be discovered about this this what it takes for quantum systems to be, to be in this phase of matter.
It's true. I mean, I guess the analogy does sort of extend to that is a kind of stability, right? But if your propagation of errors is below the threshold, then you are in this stable state where you can perform computations. But it's essentially as long as everything else being equal, it'll just stay in that state of error correctedness, I guess is what I'm saying. It's just that, I kind of get what you're saying in terms of the analogy of the phase transition. Yeah, exactly. It's super interesting.
Cool stuff. And Dorit, I mean, just as observers of the space, it appears from where we sit that it's been a big year this past year in quantum error correction. It feels like there's numerous both theoretical and practical breakthroughs. I mean, do you feel like the momentum around the powerful expression of new quantum error correction technologies is growing and strengthening?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly from various directions. Also, there are these discoveries of the LDPC codes. They are amazing mathematical objects that might have practical implications very soon. There are also amazing developments in the area of error mitigation. So right now we are not yet at the place where we actually can perform in physical systems really useful quantum error correction. But on the other hand, there is sort of the error mitigation techniques in which we don't have ability to reset gates, but we just have the ability to reduce the effect of errors on quantum circuits and quantum algorithms. That is sort of so people often think of this as kind of a discontinuous path from the area of the NISQ era to the full tolerance era. But actually, I think I'm more in favor of I think Jay Gambetta is one of the advocates for the opposite point of view in which the progress towards fully fault-tolerant quantum computers is kind of continuous. And I think that's true. I think that basically we're going to see that it's not exactly clear. It's not as if we'll get to the fault-tolerant era and then that's it. We enter the door. This is where we are. We will see more and more evolutions and progresses towards that on larger and larger systems, better and better noise rates, et cetera. So I see this as a more continuous path.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting too. I mean, we've seen, like Bacon Shore demonstrated on trapped ions by, I think, Ken Brown and others. More recently, the fault tolerant, you were saying, Kevin, there's a experiment on the nitrogen vacancy.
I believe so, yeah.
It was below the threshold, right? They actually were able to, but I mean, it's a very small system, but it seems like there's sort of, and then as you were saying, the Jay Gambetta at IBM and the superconducting circuits are sort of pursuing more of a you know, increased gate fidelities and find new strategies for mitigating errors. It feels like there's sort of different horses in the race, so to speak, that are all coming at it from different directions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yeah, and I think one of the things that are going to change, so the difference between error mitigation and error correction is really whether we have reset gates and also the level, the noise rate, essentially. But it seems like it might be possible. I mean, it seems that systems are going to be slowly evolving towards fulfilling all the requirements of fault-tolerant quantum computation. For example, reset gates might be easier to apply. You know, you need reset gates in order to get rid of entropy. The entropy gets into the system and starts warming up the system, and you have to get rid of it. And we proved already a long time ago that you basically need constant rate of getting rid of entropy, because the entropy just comes in a constant rate. But reset gates are often easier to do on the sort of on the edges of the quantum computer, and not necessarily very close, especially in 2D systems. Maybe you would start with not sufficiently many reset gates, but still more than zero. So this is just an example for what one could see as an intermediate step between error mitigation and fault tolerance.
And Dorit, this is really fascinating material. Thank you. And for our audience, could you just do a quick rundown on this idea of the reset gate?
Oh, so a reset gate basically, okay, so what's a reset gate? It's just a gate that takes any qubit, and no matter what the state of that qubit is, it replaces it by a qubit in the state zero. Now, it's, of course, going to be noisy, so it's not going to be exactly zero, but it's very close to zero. That's the reset gate. And why is it needed? Well, the point is that when you have errors and noise and decoherence, the entropy in the qubits is just accumulating, and you don't know exactly what the state is, so you can't just rotate it to the state zero. If you knew exactly what the state of a qubit was, and you knew that it was, for example, one, you could rotate it back to zero, and you didn't. That wouldn't be a special gate. But a reset gate is something that actually takes a qubit with high entropy and makes it into a qubit with a particular state, an exact state, which is zero entropy or very low entropy.
There must be impossible levels of entropy that you just don't know where it is and its rotation and spin flips and so forth. And so the reset gate gives you surety about the reestablishment of a known state.
And once you have this known state, then this could be a place where you can throw your entropy into. That's sort of a place to put entropy in. It's like a refrigerator. If you didn't have these, if your qubit is already very warm or has a lot of entropy, then there's no place for it to put more entropy in, and then you can't use it in order to cool the rest of the system. So the real problem with errors that start accumulating in the quantum state is that the entropy grows, and you want to get rid of it, because entropy growing means that the state is no longer what you wanted it to be. It has various things that you don't know that were added to the state. You want to get rid of them. You want to somehow put this excessive entropy somewhere else. And for that, you need this somewhere else to exist close to the qubit that you want to correct. These are the reset gates that prepare these qubits in the state that is, you know, that it's ready to get this entropy.
And I guess the specific implementation would just, it's an engineering challenge depending on the modality of the qubit you're working with, right?
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in some cases you would just have to wait. I mean, sometimes the solution is just to wait until the qubit relaxes to its ground state. But that can take a long time. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, actually active reset gates where you measure, and then based on the outcome of the measurement, you correct the state of the qubit so that it becomes zero. But then you have to apply a measurement.
Right.
And there are various approaches to this.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, listening to you, it sounds like, as you said, if you feel like there's sort of a continuous, we're on a continuous path rather than a discontinuous path to fault tolerance, then is it safe to say that you feel like the challenges are primarily engineering in nature, and we have sort of enough science under our belt, so to speak, to enable that engineering to get to fault tolerance?
Well, I think that has been true from 96 or 97.
Okay.
And already since then, the fault tolerance theorem basically provides a mathematical proof that, assuming that the noise is, you know, that it satisfies certain conditions and that it's below this threshold, you can actually perform error correction and you can actually perform quantum computation in the presence of noise without paying too much overhead. And since then, I should say, of course, there's been a huge amount of excellent, you know, amazing works providing much, much better constructions and much more efficient constructions. So it's never been, I think the real argument, if there is an argument, is whether the assumptions underlying the fault tolerance theorem really hold. And also, assuming that the assumptions, mainly the locality of the noise, really hold, then there is the very, very immense technical challenge of making the requirements, you know, of achieving these requirements. But I don't think anyone thinks that it's new physics that needs to be discovered.
Interesting. And Dory, I mean, I don't want to corner you, but would you be willing to speculate on, you know, the timeline for this engineering? I mean, I know that's uncomfortable.
How long?
Exactly. I just, so hard to answer, I know, and predicting the future, very hazardous stuff. But still, I mean, any speculation you'd care to share?
Well, as I said, it's not a single point. I think that the fault tolerance is not going to be, you know, we're not going to wake up and have a fault tolerance computer available somewhere in the world without any preparation. There are sort of lots of things that need to happen. For example, an increase of the number of qubits that are controlled, as well as the reducing the infidelities in the gates all over the quantum computer, not just with, you know, your best gates are have fidelities 10 to the minus 3, but maybe the rest of the gates have infidelities 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus, I don't know. So my guess is that this is going to be a continuous path. And my guess, I don't know, I don't want to, I guess I'm recorded now. My personal guess is that it should probably be pretty soon, like within maybe a few years, until we see actually some interesting quantum advantages that require significant reduction in the noise to achieve on a few hundreds of logical qubits. But this is not yet sufficient to see quantum full-fledged quantum computers, full-fledged fault-tolerant quantum computers. For that, I think the right order of magnitude is 10 years.
Right.
Something along these lines.
Got it. So interesting. And you also mentioned this, you know, gradual transition out of the NISQ era into perhaps a more rigorous fault tolerant era of quantum computation. There's numerous people who have skepticism and some faith, right, in the capacity of the NISQ era machines making some sort of positive contribution towards, the not just the theory of computation, but actual practical problems. Are you a NISQ optimist or a NISQ pessimist when it comes to, you know, real world applications?
So once again, I think that the exact definition of NISQ is not so sharp because of this continuous path.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But I am in fact a NISQ optimist, if you want to call it this way, because of the following observation. In an old paper of mine with Michael Benor and with Noam Nissan and with Russell Impagliasso, we actually observed, already in 96, we observed that that log-depth quantum circuits can be made fault-tolerant even without reset gates. as long as the noise rate is below a certain threshold. So, and Richard Cleave and John Watrous, in a beautiful paper from 2000, I think, they showed that Shor's algorithm can be done using a hybrid machine of classical computation and log depth quantum computers.
Oh, interesting.
So if you combine the two results, basically, we didn't actually realize that, but basically we've known without knowing for a long time that Shor's algorithm is in NISQ, meaning it can be done using NISQ devices. Recently, I've been to QIP, and there was a beautiful talk by about a paper by I forget the list of authors, but it's a beautiful paper called "The Complexity of NISQ." And the complexity of NISQ, they define the complexity class NISQ, and you can argue about the exact definition, but the real point is that they gave a definition, and the definition is basically that you have a classical computer and so it's a hybrid machine of a classical computer capable of doing polynomial classical computations with access to log depth or to noisy quantum computers. And I'm saying log depth because after logarithmically many time steps, the entropy grows to the point that it's basically as useful as completely random states. So basically, you can think of NISQ as this hybrid machine of classical computers with access to log depth quantum systems. And that contains Shor's algorithm.
So
it contains Shor's algorithm, even if these log depth quantum systems are noisy, as long as the error rate is below a certain threshold. So these reset gates might not be the main issue. These log depth quantum systems, they don't need reset gates. Basically, the issue is that the error rate needs to be below a certain threshold. And I personally believe, so that actually shows that these log depth systems, quantum systems, if they come together with classical machines that control them, they're extremely powerful.
Well, and in fact, you just gave me a lot more understanding into IBM's move last spring to shift their roadmap to much more emphasis of these sort of very tightly coupled classical and NISQ style machines. Like, that sounds much more powerful than I think I was initially imagining.
Yes, I think that's a common sort of intuition that log depth systems or the very shallow quantum circuits would not be so powerful. But in fact, if they come together with hybrid machine, they could get to do Shor's algorithm, and
tons more, right? I mean, there's all sorts of powerful problems with the domain of quantum variational eigensolvers, right? I mean,
yes. So that's true. However, asymptotic advantage is not. I mean, we are talking about practical advantages, and there,
sure, yeah,
it might very well be that we will see really beautiful advantages very soon. And also, as I said, I think that very soon we'll actually be able to move out of this NISQ devices to devices with some reset gates, and we already have reset gates available in some machines. And so, again, the NISQ devices are changing over time. So they're getting more and more powerful, and they don't just remain in their in the framework of no reset gates, no error correction whatsoever, and just do computation and wait for the entropy to accumulate.
And on the practical versus asymptotic point, the paper that you did recently on random circuit sampling, I guess that was providing theoretical proof of not having asymptotic advantage in that sort of regime, right? The I think what you proved was that the more qubits in the random circuit sampling experiment, the less advantage there was when they're noisy qubits. Is that right?
I wouldn't put it that way, that the more qubits you have, the less advantage you have. But what we showed is basically that if you have, there is this branch of attempts to show quantum advantage, which is really heroic, I think, and there are amazing experiments that were done, like Google's experiment, that that basically used random circuit sampling, where you pick up a random quantum circuit, and you just apply this random quantum circuit and measure at the end, and you do that for several quantum circuits, and then you perform some statistical test on the outcomes of these measurements, and like, for example, linear cross entropy benchmark, or there are other statistical tests. I don't want to go into the exact definition, but there are some statistical tests on the outcome of the measurements of the, you know, you apply a random quantum circuit, then you measure, and you take several results of those measurements, and you perform some classical computation on those. And the idea was that whatever the outcome of this classical computation is, random quantum circuit sampling can produce it for not too deep quantum circuits, whereas classical computations will require super polynomial time to do. If you're thinking of asymptotic advantages, and what we showed is that no matter what statistical test you apply, we can basically mimic this with a classical computer. So we have a way to take the model, the noisy random quantum circuit model, and compute and basically simulate it and simulate several circuits of it, and then compute the classical function, whatever classical function you want. If you use it on your quantum circuits, then you can also use it on our classical simulator. And then we basically mimic the quantum experiment. So that means, we mimic it to within some total variation distance, a small one, arbitrarily small, inverse polynomially small. So once you can mimic that, this means that there cannot be scalable quantum advantage. So this means that, I'm putting an asterisk here, there are lots of caveats to this. It's not, well, I'll get back to the caveats, but basically the lesson is that we think that random circuit sampling cannot be the basis for scalable experimental violation of what's called the extended Church-Turing thesis.
Yes.
So the extended Church-Turing thesis states that all computational models can be simulated in polynomial time by a probabilistic Turing machine, classical Turing machine, and the whole quantum computation area relies on the belief that quantum computers violate this thesis, and we still don't have experimental evidence for this violation.
And it's a treacherous area. I mean, first, fascinating and powerful, right? It's a fascinating, powerful intellectual quest to sort of like try to find experimental evidence that would violate the extended Church-Turing thesis. And numerous attempts that people thought they had breakthroughs on, they've been sort of, those algorithms on a quantum computer have been dequantized. Yes. So lots of attempts leading to a turnaround. So it seems like a very treacherous area to try to make a breakthrough in.
Yes. But I think you're referring to the machine learning algorithms that were dequantized.
Yes.
And
yeah.
These are not. Okay. So these are two different topics. The machine learning algorithms that were fascinatingly dequantized by Teng and collaborators later. This is not about experimental evidence for quantum advantage, but it's just about the question of whether ideal quantum computers, a mathematical model, can achieve exponential speedups over classical ideal computers. And within this arena of machine learning, those particular algorithms turned out to be not as powerful as people thought.
Yes.
But yeah, they led to very fascinating results in the classical machine learning domain, but they weren't leading to quantum advantages. However, when people seek quantum evidence, experimental evidence for quantum advantage, this is not what we're talking about. We're not talking about finding faster solutions to problems. But we're talking about the question of whether we already have right now, before we solve Shor's algorithm on a quantum computer in 10 years, already now, do we have experimental evidence that there is a good reason for us to believe that those quantum systems are really capable of exponential advantage over classical systems? And that is not something, so remember this phase transition. So basically we haven't really probed the phase of the high complexity regime of quantum mechanics. And we currently don't have any good evidence, any viable evidence that we have, that really quantum systems are capable of performing information processing in a way which resembles this high complexity that is required from the fault tolerance regime. Maybe I should explain this a little bit more. I think it's really, really mind-boggling, this fact that we don't really, really have this yet. So one can ask, so if we go back to Feynman, Feynman, I mean, the original motivation of Feynman was basically the fact that quantum evolutions are extremely hard to simulate. So one can ask, well, isn't the very fact that quantum systems evolve as they do already experimental evidence, that quantum systems are so hard, you know, that they perform something extremely difficult from the computational complexity point of view? So, right, this is sort of the first response to, do we have any evidence for quantum advantage, for experimental evidence, for scalable quantum advantage? And the answer to this is that, unfortunately, so far, I don't think anyone has managed to actually define a computational problem that an existing physical system solves, that we can verify that it actually solves it, and that we have evidence that that it solves it for sufficiently many instances that we can really view it as something that scales. There is no such suggestion. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist and that we don't, you know, I'm not saying that we don't already have somewhere in one of the physics papers existing evidence, but no one actually pointed at such an evidence and said, this is something that I propose as a challenge for classical computers. Just compute what this physical systems have already computed and tell me, and then if you can't, then this is evidence for quantum advantage.
And there's such deep and powerful questions, and this detail is fantastic, Dorit. Thank you. I mean, and so I want to again ask you to speculate. I mean, where do you think this will net out? I mean, do you feel like there will be at some point a powerful breakthrough on the theory here that would show that ECT is false?
Okay, so I'm very optimistic about this. Actually, I think so. Okay, so I don't know if that's exactly your question, but one can ask: is there already existing evidence? And the other question that one can ask is, can we actually generate evidence from existing systems like NISQ systems? These are two different questions. I'm actually, because of the power that I told you about before, about the power of NISQ devices that already in principle can implement Shor's algorithm, if the error rate is below a certain threshold. And I personally think that probably they are very powerful also with higher error rates. So I personally think that NISQ devices are capable of providing evidence for scalable quantum advantage. But I don't know. I don't know yet how to point on that problem.
It'll have to be the topic of your next research paper, I guess.
Working on that.
Yeah, good. or your product of your startup. I mean, maybe KEDMA can solve that. That would be good too.
KEDMA is dealing with making error, you know, making quantum devices capable of performing VQE and other quantum algorithms work as best they can, you know, extracting the quantum power out of existing devices. Excellent. And as a, an industry company, we're not worried about proving theorems and scalable right. advantages and stuff like that. We're working, right. We're worried about the practicalities. And in my other hat, my research hat, I'm doing these questions.
Right. That's, I always think that's a really healthy interplay between the search for proofs and the search for just practical application.
Yeah, I have to say that I was surprised. I was very surprised about the constructive interference between working in industry and working on theoretical questions. I have to say I was expecting destructive interference, and I'm actually seeing a lot of inspiration going in both directions.
That's excellent.
That's really interesting. And tell us more about that. How does that work? Do you just feel like it's you know, kind of a group spirit of pushing forward and ahead and inspiring each other via competition, or is there some other underlying, I don't know, framework of dialogue or theory that is helping enrich the field?
I have to say, I think it's much more mundane than that. for me, it's basically the fact that you can switch between different types of thinking. When you go back, it's like resting. When you go back to something that you haven't thought about for a little while and you have been thinking in a different way, then your point of view is different. And I find the switches between different ways of thinking very fruitful.
Oh, beautiful.
Interesting.
Really cool.
Interesting. So, Dory, we're at about an hour now. I'm mindful of your time. I don't want to make you stay up later than you already have, because I know it's late in Israel. But I'm really curious. Is there anything? I mean, we were saying, you know, error correction has been making great strides. The systems that are being built are getting you know, higher and higher gate fidelities. Is there something in particular you're excited about in the next year or two that you know, that you think will be another step forward in that sort of continuous progress?
Well, we've been talking a lot about quantum computation and about error mitigation, quantum error correction, but one direction which we haven't mentioned at all is it relates to sensing and to basically using quantum computational ideas to perform new types of measurements and new, you know, measurements with much higher precision. And I think this is really, so I've been very interested in this aspect of basically using ideas from quantum computation and ideas from information processing and entanglement and so on, in the context of actually thinking of new types of experiments, which are interactive between the physical system that we want to perform experiment on and another device which could be thought of as a small quantum computer, et cetera. And we've actually shown a year ago, I think, with Jordan Kotler and Xialong Shi, that such devices are capable of achieving exponential improvements in efficiency and resources. So measurements and experiments completely can look completely differently in the world where you have quantum computers and quantum information processing. There could be entanglement between systems that you can perform measurements on and some kind of information processing devices. And I think this is just an example. Our example, and there was also an experiment done on Google Sycamore of such an experiment like that of time reversal measurement, which was much more efficient. And I think that this direction of thinking of measurements and experiments in a different way, where quantum computers are aiding those experiments, is going to develop into a whole new field of its own.
It's almost you're taking a step backwards in time from von Neumann at IAS to Norbert Wiener and cybernetics, right? Like the control systems and feedback systems being much more gaining, you know, having efficiency gains.
Right. Except now they're quantum.
Except now they're quantum. Yeah, exactly.
And so, Dorit, this is such a cool topic. I'm so glad you brought it up. And we do agree. Yeah, sensing is, I think, an underrated aspect, right, of the QC movement. Just for our audience, could you help them and us even on giving concrete examples of the types of experiments and sensors that might be arriving as a result of these advancements?
Okay, one example is the example I mentioned earlier, which may be somewhat contrived, but I think it's very interesting. It's a measurement of the time symmetry type of a physical system. And what the example that I told you about that you know, the experiment on Google Sycamore was actually a way to show that if you entangle the system that you want to measure to another qubit, you can actually perform a measurement that sort of classifies the time reversal symmetry of that system much more efficiently. But it's not, I don't think this, I mean, there are lots of examples, machine learning examples or examples of this type of where you actually can learn quantum systems aided with more quantum systems. And there are, in fact, there are many, many examples from many different directions. So one example that I have a paper on is with Alex Wetzger and others, is an example where when you measure, during the measurement, you sort of apply a very, very rudimentary error correction so that the signal is being corrected while it's being measured. And since you're correcting it while you're measuring it, you can actually get to much higher precisions because it doesn't decay. So that's another example, but I you can think of many, many different examples where if you have a quantum processor next to the system that you're trying to measure and you make use of that, you could actually either increase the precision or do various tricks to remove, you know, to improve the resource counts of the measurement.
That's really fascinating.
So many possibilities there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I believe it's something with infinitely many possibilities. It's very tightly related to quantum algorithms.
Interesting.
You can think of a quantum measurement as a quantum algorithm, where the input is your quantum system, and you're trying to learn something about that quantum system, but you also have it's sort of entangled with a quantum computer. So it's like a generalization of a quantum algorithm.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh. So you expect advances in adiabatic computation, quantum walks, you know, maybe topological systems, all of those is having pertinent direct, you know, support for these new quantum sensing applications. Yeah,
I wouldn't know about specifically about quantum walks, et cetera. But yes, I think that any quantum measurements and quantum experimental protocols are certain examples of quantum algorithms, and progresses in quantum algorithms is going to affect and to suggest new protocols in experiments.
Interesting.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, you've just opened the door to a whole other collection of topics that I would love to dig into. So,
but it's late in your time.
Have you back, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're so grateful for your time. Thank you. Yeah. Very enjoyable conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
That was a great conversation.
Wow, really fantastic.
Super enjoyable. I, you know, Kevin, I thought it was so interesting to hear her say essentially that she feels like it's primarily an engineering challenge to getting to fault tolerance or fault resistance, sort of, you know, industrial scale quantum computers. I mean, I typically hear more of an emphasis on discontinuous innovation being required, but she
right.
she said exactly the opposite, that she feels like it's an engineering so. Challenge yeah. and it's going to be continuous progress towards that goal, which was really super interesting to hear from such a credible source.
yeah, she's got some backbone, some authority on that one. So you yes. want to pay attention. And also the time frame, she's talking, 5 to 10 years, and there's going to yeah. be some pretty powerful, disruptive, new appearances on the scene. I was also struck by this is a result that's been known for some time, but she was, I think, really helpful in underlining it. This whole rigorous notion that's been published recently on the time complexity analysis around NISC era machines. I mean, right. this NISC acronym is kind of a bit of jargon, but you've got actually rigorous mathematical definitions now of time complexity characteristics, space complexity characteristics of NISC era machines and what they can do. And what really struck me was her connecting this idea of some forms of quantum algorithms can be rendered as essentially log depth circuits. That means the size of the input problem when factored into a logarithm gives you back a depth limit on the number of quantum circuits, which is of course quite pertinent towards the amount of error correction and
right.
coherence time you have to muster in order to get to a successful computation. And powerfully, the Shor's algorithm for factorization it resides in that class. Sketching out the possibility that there could be, who knows, maybe even some early breakthroughs on real implementation of that algorithm faster than most people anticipate. So I thought that was really fascinating.
It's true. I mean, it's another example of sort of potentially being overly fixated as an industry on this, the hypothetical sort of Shor machine being, whatever, 100,000, fault tolerant qubits, so they can run the algorithm in sort of perfect, clean room conditions. But it really gave me perspective on why there's such an urgent sort of drive by vendors like IBM, for example, whose roadmap last spring was revised to have much deeper and tighter integration of classical compute resources with the quantum, the qubit chips. Because I mean, that sounds like what they're anticipating is that there will be that type of tight coupling with this sort of log depth circuitry in a hybrid kind of algorithm might actually yield some significant results in the nearer term.
Seems so likely that they're following that same logic as well.
Yeah.
I also was just stunningly amazed with her really interesting idea around this parallel, right, between different types of quantum error correction regimes inside quantum computers and phases of matter. And the amazing thing, she's not just talking about it being a interesting analogy and like, wouldn't it be helpful to think of it this way? She's actually asserting that there could be actually a tight, mathematical isomorphism, right, between these two. I mean, the physics and mathematics of phases of matter, that's some deep stuff.
Yeah.
And seeing some sort of connection between those two in rigorous mathematical terms. Wow. I mean, that would be not just a beautiful idea and an amazing observation, but wow, an earth-shaking theorem. So power on, Dorit.
she started with the description of the threshold theorem in these very operational, almost, I was thinking of feeds and stocks almost. I mean, she rendered it down to the simplicity of if your errors propagate slower than your correction can be affected, then you're good, right? I mean, that's essentially what it was. And that sounds like, as she said, an engineering problem. But then at the very end, she flipped it around to and there may be some really fundamental science sort of embedded in that simple proposition, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah, right. Good times.
Excellent. Well, that was another enjoyable conversation for us. I hope our listeners enjoyed it as well. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Thank you all for your time.
Okay, that's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamido. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at PodFi. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes, and or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.